on this, so I'm going to really whip through, hopefully in less than 20 minutes, of some really good information. I will start by telling you, I was raised in the middle-class mental model. That is to say, my internal picture of how the world works is based on my middle-class upbringing. My mom was a nurse, and my dad was a teacher. I was a successful athlete and student and went on to a private college to further my education and play sports. Very middle class. Until I gave birth to my first child at age 19 as a sophomore in college. Not the middle class norm. Thankfully, I was a well-resourced and well-supported young mom. Becoming a mom, stepping out of that middle class mental model, sparked in me a real fire to want to change the world somehow. I graduated school and became a teacher, but I never really felt satisfied, never felt like I was doing enough until I found NEMSCA and school success and eventually poverty education. This is what I have been searching for, and I am incredibly thankful to be able to share my mission with you. Shortly after graduating college, I was married, but after nearly 10 years of marriage and two additional children, I found myself divorced, my ex living 3,000 miles away, and was unemployed, contributing almost nothing to our children's upbringing. I worked hard, 7 days a week most years, and always just made ends meet. But it wasn't until a car ride with my kiddos a few years ago that I was able to label our situation. We were chatting about my job and the people I try to help, and my daughter said simply, "Mom, we were in poverty a lot of years, weren't we?" She was right, and that was my aha moment. The moment I realized I wasn't alone in my struggles. The moment I began to understand myself and my decisions and motivations and those of the population with which I work every single day. Now, our mental model exists below our awareness, and they determine how we act and what we believe and where we spend our time. Many of you probably had a relative that grew up in the Depression, yes? Maybe a grandparent or a parent? Okay. And today you find yourself doing things that they did, for example, saving plastic bags or rubber bands, right? Exactly. Well, they saved those things because they were poor and people had almost nothing. You were doing it because that mental model was passed down to you through what we call the intergenerational transfer of knowledge. Two, each class is motivated by different things. Where we spend our time and what we focus on depends very much on the mental model in which we were raised. Those mental models each have a different motivator. People in poverty are completely and totally motivated by relationships. They're people. Doing right by them, making them feel good and happy. If you'd like to really connect to someone and help a person in poverty, you must tie their goals and success to the relationships in their lives. For example, if you complete this job readiness course, you could provide a better and more stress-free life for your mom. If you graduate from high school, you'll be able to get that job that will take the stress off your parents and give a better life to your siblings. Now, middle-class folks, we're motivated by achievement. Think about it. What do you do? Where does your child go to college? My son won first prize in soccer. My niece just got her master's. But we're all about achievement in the middle class. And people in wealth are motivated very much by connections, something foreign to me, but how can you help me? Who are you connected to? What can you get me? So if you go to a party with Fred in poverty, people will want to know who you have the relationship, right? This is Fred's cousin's girlfriend. And then you're welcomed in. It's who you know, right? Who your relationship is with. If you go to that same party with Fred in middle class, they will take you to a party, and most likely the first thing you're going to be asked is what?
What do you do?
Where did you go to college? Where do your kids go to school? And then you'd be welcome. Fred and wealth, they don't care who you know, unless it's somebody that can benefit them, right? I'm the editor of a newspaper. I'm connected to X political party. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Okay. So how do we reach those in poverty? 100% through relationships, through people, through building those bonds with them. I would like to encourage you all today to try your hardest to suspend your mental models. Try to think out of your box and from another perspective. Try to leave behind the mindset of how things should be. Now, we define poverty as the extent to which one does without resources. probably different than you're thinking. We all think money, right? And explain that a little more. So to really have this poverty conversation, we do need to get a few things out of the way first. First, there are five basic classes that have been researched heavily. Old money, the Carnegies, the Vanderbilts, people who've had it forever, right? New money, which is lottery winners or perhaps a professional athlete that comes into some big cash. The middle class, which I think we're all familiar with what defines that, yeah? Situational poverty, which are people like me and my kids, right? We were plunged into poverty by a specific situation, divorce, job loss, God forbid, death, or illness. And generational poverty, those who have had nothing for generations. Now keep in mind that nothing is absolute that I'm going to say today. There are always exceptions. And understand that people move back through this continuum at about one level per generation. Today I'm referring mostly to generational poverty. Research shows us that it takes about three generations to fall into poverty and about three to get out. The work that we do today with folks in poverty might not be positively evident for three generations. I know I have felt many times over the years that the work that I'm doing, the barriers that I'm removing from my students and families' lives, isn't having any sort of impact. I have to remind myself that things don't change overnight, and that I'm planting a seed that will continue to grow for three generations. And that's what gives me hope to keep going back to that world every day. The research also tells us that if we are to address poverty, I mean really come to the table and work on a solution, we must look at four pillars. Individual behaviors, community conditions, exploitation, and finally the big political and economic structures. One person cannot fix everything, neither can legislation without community buy-in, or removal of exploitation. We must do it all. We must look at all four pillars. This was one of the slides that I had to show you that you couldn't really see, but if you look across the board at these four pillars, there are a lot of things that are similar. For example, individually, the first thing on my list is racism. Individuals can be racist. Communities can be racist. Institutions can be racist. And of course, our political and economic structures can have policies that are racist, right? So we need to look at racism across the board. And it goes down the list. How money is loaned to people in poverty. How people in poverty tend to make bad money decisions. These are institutional and individual problems. And until we face all four, the problem will not go away. Now, a phrase that has become a part of my daily vernacular, the people who are close to me know it and they get annoyed with me, I'm sure, is tyranny of the moment. This is when the need to act overwhelms the willingness people have to learn. The healthier you are psychologically, the less you may seem to need to change, the more you can change. Thinking of this oppositely with our folks in poverty, the more you need to change, the less you're able. Those in poverty live in the tyranny of the moment constantly. There is always something to worry about, some crisis to deal with. This is like having your bandwidth full, having so much to think about in regards to safety, crisis management, food, shelter, the basics, that you cannot make an educated or thoughtful choice. There is not room in your brain to think and absolutely no ability to forward plan and think about the future. You can only think about now. The seemingly right choice may never cross your mind if you're in poverty, at least not when you're supposed to be making that choice. I have a student with whom I have worked for several years. I get choked up because I love her dearly. She's 20 and single and has suffered years upon years of trauma and stress and loss. She's also a mom. Her children are 11 months, and she's due in just about a month with number 3. She lives in generational poverty very deeply. Now, this gal is a mom, so our middle-class mental model would tell us that she should always make the right choices for her children, right? Well, she doesn't. When she gets a little extra money, she doesn't buy formula or diapers usually. What she'll buy are stick-on meals and body spray for herself, chicken nuggets for her babies, and cigarettes for her baby daddy. Insert eye roll, huh? When you're behind her at Walmart or the dollar store, like, what is this girl doing? Well, Today I'm asking you to look at her compassionately. Like a young woman who is constantly at her max, worried about having a safe place to live, diapers, food, formula, these are real. She cannot make the obvious choice. The only choice that feels best, well, pretty hands, smiling babies, a happy baby daddy, in the moment that all feels really good. And so those are the choices that are made. Another major factor of poverty is language. I think about language a lot as a language instructor, but in the English language, we have five registers. The first one is frozen. We use it in church all the time. We sing the doxology, we recite the Lord's Prayer, maybe the Pledge of Allegiance, right? That's our frozen language. Then we have formal language, and that's how I'm speaking to you now, using a large vocabulary, full sentences. It's the language that society functions on, agencies, institutions, including schools and churches. We have consultative, that might be how the doctor delivers some news to you at an appointment. And then we have the casual register, which is a language between friends, the language of poverty. It is has much smaller amount of vocabulary and relies heavily, like 80% on body language. And then we have the intimate register, which is a language of lovers, twins, and of sexual harassment. So when we talk about language, it is imperative to distinguish the different registers of language and assist people in developing that formal register. That is to model, without shaming, formal register for those in poverty. It is also necessary to understand how language register and story structure and language experience influences cognitive development. I'll hit you with some research. So our research shows that children ages 1 to 4 in a welfare-based economic group are exposed to 13 million words. And for every 2 discounts, there's only 1 affirmation. So for 1 out of what? For every 2 corrections, right? Working class children are exposed to double that amount of words, about 26 million words. They're given 2 attaboys for every single correction. And then finally, children from a professional class home are exposed to 45 million words and are praised 6 times for every discount. This undeniably influences language. So what does it mean? What it means is that the adult in the poverty mental model standing in front of you has a fraction of the vocabulary of that middle class person or a person from wealth. Now think about this. How comfortable would you feel in a meeting? A doctor's appointment, a job interview, a parent-teacher conference in your children's school, if you had 1/3 of the vocabulary of the people speaking to you. It is scary, it is intimidating, and it can come across as not caring, as being lazy or unmotivated or even unintelligent. And it is important to remember that it is not. People in poverty are intelligent, caring individuals who may not have the words to express themselves or even the confidence to try. Honor them, respect them, and treat them with compassion. We need to model and teach formal register without shaming. If you're in a position to create literature, like flyers or information that might be handed out to folks in poverty, it makes good sense to use bullet points, less difficult vocabulary, and a lot of graphics. This is not dumbing down. It is making information more accessible to your audience. We are in the process at NEMSCA of revamping everything, our websites, every flyer, every handout, all of our rat cards. They were full of these paragraph upon paragraph for folks who didn't understand them. So to make things more understandable for the people you serve and the audience you want to be reading that stuff is imperative. Also, conversely, people in the poverty mental model are experts at body language. They can read your body and gesticulations immediately and will form opinions and beliefs based on how you carry yourself and how you look at them. While those in poverty need to be guided to use the formal register, those of us in the formal register must be aware of our body language. If you've ever worked with children, that's always my basis because I've been in education forever. I've had kids or heard kids say to me, "Well, that teacher hates my guts." Well, sweetheart, this is the first day. You've never spoken to that teacher. Well, that kid in poverty sees a teacher who's stressed out, maybe at her desk on the first day of school, kind of like this, maybe talking to her class like this, maybe not even looking when the child's speaking to her. That body language is interpreted immediately and always very negatively. I have a friend who's a police officer, and he learned very quickly in his cupping that you don't walk up to somebody and talk to them like this. Immediately, you're going to put somebody on edge. You don't ever leave your sunglasses on, and you certainly never do anything like this. That guy called me a liar! I said nothing. Our body language is very, very important, and so it's really wonderful and helpful when you're working with folks to take that deep breath, take note of your stance, take note of your facial expressions, and really when someone's speaking to you, go take a breath and look and listen. Again, remember, relationships motivate people in poverty, so they want that relationship with you. There is another true language, another true barrier for people in, language is a true barrier for most people who live in generational poverty, and recognizing that barrier is the first step to help removing it. And it helps to even that playing field. Another research-based barrier is a little more subtle than language. How many of you have a cell phone with you today? How many of you turned it off when you got in here or silenced it when you came into church? Who told you to do that? Nobody, right? That is what we call a hidden rule. Society is full of them. And individuals bring with them a set of hidden rules from the class in which they were raised. And knowledge of these hidden rules are exceptionally important for a person to function successfully in society. There are hidden rules about many, many things based on economic class. The most obvious and easiest one to describe is food. The issue with food in poverty is quantity. If you're eating at a house of folks in poverty, they're going to want to know one thing and one thing only. Are you full? Did you get enough? Right? In middle class, our hidden rule about food is, well, was it delicious? Did you like it? Did you see how I used balsamic vinaigrette to make that reduction? It's all about sort of the quality of our food, right? We have too much food. We're on diets. People in poverty are on diets. And in wealth, the food issue is about presentation. We eat with our eyes first, of course, right? Did it look good? Was it well presented? There are hidden rules about money based on class as well. And this one answers a lot of questions, I think, for people who really scratch their heads when they see poor folks making interesting purchases. Poverty, money is to be used and spent. And what motivates people in poverty? Relationships. So they're going to use and spend their money on their people. In the middle class, we manage our money. We make sure our fridges are full, we have our retirement, we've got that little bit set away for our vacation. It is managed, and we know what's going on. We know how much is in the checking, we know how much is in the savings, and how much I need to put in a month to retire, right? And in wealth, money is to be conserved and invested. When we get to possessions, things change a little bit. In poverty, what do you suppose is the number one possession? Well, it's people, it's relationships. In the middle class, I love to bring this up because it makes people kind of laugh at themselves. In the middle class, it's all about things. We've got basements full of things and attics full of things and shelves full of things. And we actually can go purchase, we can rent buildings to put more of our things in. Right? We like things in middle class, as many as you can get. And finally, in wealth, it's all about one kind of objects. Legacies, pedigrees. There's a funny story I can share, and it's about a fine piece of art. I always go with Picasso. He's my favorite. So let's say I give Fred in poverty this one-of-a-kind, beautiful Picasso. What do you suppose Fred in poverty is going to do with that piece of art? Sell that thing, right? He's going to sell that, and he's probably going to take the whole neighborhood camping or buy everybody a cell phone and a case of Monster. We're going to have a party on the block with the money from that Picasso. And everybody who's ever helped me is going to share in that, right? So what if we give Fred in middle class that Picasso? Well, first, after they take a picture and put it up on their social media, then you're going to sell it, right? And you'll probably say, well, I'm going to pay down this bill. I'm going to put some money in retirement. And maybe we'll take a vacation. Fred and Wealth, well, it's going to hang that on a wall and make sure everybody knows that it's there when they come to the house, suddenly share their Picasso with you, right? I encourage you to honor those in poverty and respect their hidden rules. After two or three generations in poverty, people don't have a lot of stuff. Most of their decisions are made against three factors, three forces that drive their rules and decisions. And they are relationships, and attainment, and survival. When you spend most of your life in the tyranny of the moment, any chance you have to relieve stress and feel good is seized. That's why you see people in poverty with huge TVs, gaming systems, cigarettes, fancy cell phones, an inability to plan for the future, and an undeniable need to feel good and make the people they love happy. Members of the group that has the most power, the most money, or the greatest number of people think their hidden rules are the best. So if you don't use them, you're viewed as dumb or rude. If you don't know the hidden rules of the middle class, which are the rules that institutions, communities, agencies, schools, businesses, all run in, navigating that job interview or that meeting or even a church service can be very difficult and very awkward. So finally, I'd like to remind you of that definition of poverty, the extent to which an individual does without resources. Again, not just poor folks, right? The extent to which people do without resources. Well, to have that conversation, we need to define what those resources are. The first resource, of course, is the glaring one. It is financial. Of course, if you don't have the financial means to purchase the goods and services that you need and sustain yourself, that's going to contribute, right? But then we also have our emotional resource, and that's being able to choose and control your emotional responses, particularly in negative situations, without engaging in self-destructive behavior. It shows through your choices. When something terrible happens, do you have an eruption and go on a bender, or are you able to sit down and talk to your support system? That's an emotional resource, right? Mental, having mental abilities and acquired skills, reading, writing, computing, to deal with day-to-day life. Having that mental resource is key. Spiritual, believing in a divine purpose, something bigger than you, something bigger out there for guidance and purpose. And physical, having your physical self healthy, being able to move. If we don't have that, that's going to contribute to our class. And support systems. Support systems are the things that keep folks in situational poverty with their head above water, right? Having friends, family, backup resources available to access in times of need. These are external resources that we depend on. And I know if you really think about any of those in poverty that you work with, very few of them have resources that are stable, just others in poverty, right? No really good resource that can help you out. I kind of jinx myself when I talk about this one all the time, but God forbid I crash my car on the way home today, right? If I'm Andrea in generational poverty, maybe my cell phone only works when I've got Wi-Fi, and I don't have any Wi-Fi with me in the car, so I can't call anybody. So I'm on the street hoping to wave somebody down, probably screaming at my son, because I don't have that emotional ability to make good choices for myself. This Andrea would call her dad, he would get a tow truck, he would take it, my car, where it needed to go. Knowing my dad, he'd probably have a rental ready for me. You know, that is because I've got this support system. And when you don't have that, those little moments of crashing into the ditch become enormous crises. Then you can't make it to work, and your kid can't go to school on Monday, so now the truancy people are after you, right? Maybe you only live on wood heap and you didn't get home in time, so now your pipes are frozen because you couldn't load your wood burners. The next one is relationship and role models. And so anybody who works with other people, being a role model, being a support, being the person for someone who is in poverty or is in struggle or is struggling is incredibly important. Everybody needs that person to look at and say, oh, that's how you speak. That's how you talk to others. That's how you make decisions. And folks in poverty tend to have very few positive role models and nurturing relationships. Knowledge of hidden rules, what we just talked about. If you don't have the knowledge of hidden rules, you know, you do leave yourself when I'm in church and your rock and roll song goes off in the middle of the Lord's Prayer, right? And people, and that leads to some of these other ones, other resources, integrity and trust. Folks in poverty don't tend to have integrity and trust. If I'm in my office at work, right, and my purse is sitting out, and one of my high-risk, super poor, homeless kids come in, I tuck my purse in my drawer. Maybe I wouldn't do that with a kid who came in well-dressed and I knew he was well-resourced and had parents that kid's not going to steal from me. Well, that's my mental model, right? My middle-class mental model, removing trust and integrity from this kid without, based completely on class. Motivation and persistence. Now, you have to have energy and drive to prepare and plan and complete projects. A lot of folks say a cause of poverty, the individual cause is laziness. I'm going to refer back to my girl, my 20-year-old mom. Some people think she's lazy because she has had her food card, her food stamps, well, they're not stamps anymore, the bridge card shut off 3 times in the past, I don't know, probably 5 months. And I've actually had some people roll their eyes, oh my gosh, well, if she would just get her stuff in. DHHS went to this thing called universal caseloads. You don't have a case manager anymore. You used to be able to call up and talk to Karen. Karen, something's wrong with my food stamps. And Karen could get you hooked right back up. Now you call, and you have to leave your name and number in a queue. And then someone's supposed to get back to you. And the DHHS folks, I don't know if we have any in here. They don't like it either. But so you leave your name and number in a queue. Well, if you're one of my kids, I would say 98% of them, and parents, have no service on those cell phones. They only have service when they're able to Wi-Fi call or call you through Facebook, and they only have, they can tell you, every place in the county that has free Wi-Fi, but unless they're there, they can't receive a phone call back. So then we find out she's locked out of her dashboard because she has to have a dashboard on the computer, right, with all of her stuff, and it says, nope, not verified. So I throw the kid in my car and we drive to DHHS. Well, you have to be verified by having a credit history. So if you're a 20-year-old single mom who's never owned anything, you have no credit history. So we had to prove who she was, but we couldn't figure out how to do that because we couldn't see. Long story short, the runaround and the runaround and the runaround at all of these agencies does a very, very good job of making people seem like they have no motivation, but in fact they have tried, and they have tried, and they have tried, and they keep hitting brick walls. So having that compassion to really help people with their motivation, help people with their persistence, be an advocate, and recognize when people aren't being lazy, and help them to get some results, it's a huge resource. And finally, the formal register. If you have the emotional control and vocabulary and language ability and negotiation skills, functioning in society is great. I see it all the time with some of my students, especially now after this training. I have some kids who I can speak to and have a wonderful formal conversation about their education with, but then I hear them with their friends, and it is not formal. They can sink right down into their vernacular and have that casual conversation with their friends. To me, that's gold. That tells me that these kids know the difference between the registers. They can go to a job interview and speak well and sit up and look someone in the eye, and they can still go back to their people and fit in. The problem is when we have these kids or families or adults who can't get out of casual, they don't know, and on top of that, they're being told maybe by the world that that's okay, you understood me. We need to keep modeling that formal register. So they pick it up, so they learn. By repeating, by asking folks what they've heard, by speaking to them in the formal, I've taken to saying very often to families my whole spiel and then say, oh, what did you understand? What did you hear me say? Very often it's not what we said, so then we have to kind of work around it, but that's building skills. I could probably talk for another 3 days about this, folks. But I think my time's about up. So what I will tell you is that we need to help people in poverty assess their own resources and build them. All 11 of these. To help them explore their own situations as opposed to telling them what to do. We live in a society of, I have made this plan for you. If you follow these steps written in paragraph form, you will be a success. Well, I'll tell you what. I'll use my girlfriend's favorite story. If I'd like to lose weight and I go see my doctor will say, well, that's easy, Andrea. Do this, this, and this, and you will probably lose 10 pounds in a month. And I will look at that, and I'll say, okay. And I go back a month later, and my doctor's like, yeah, you're up a pound. Are you lazy? Right? I'm going to make opinions here. I gave you the plan. Are you just lazy? Did you not read it? Do you not understand? Well, hey, it meant nothing to me. If you were to give me a plan that said, hey, Andrea, there's a 5K. It ends at a brew pub. If you get under 25 minutes, you get a free pint. I would probably train really hard for that race and probably drop more than 10 pounds. Because it spoke to me, right? It's a plan that included me. So we need to help people explore their own situations, not tell them what to do. They need to make their own arguments for change. And please keep in mind the three-generational rule and the importance of respect, understanding, kindness, compassion, relationships, and developing these on an institutional level, community level, and an individual level. Thank you for your time.